Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1015, update on Hindutva fascism. This is being recorded on July 18th of the year 2018. As the title of the program indicates, this is going to update and flesh out further our ongoing coverage of Hindutva, that's H-I-N-D-U-T as in Tom, V as in Victor, A, fascism. This is an iteration of fascism that has manifested in India, and it traces back to the RSS. That is a Hindutva fascist organization that murdered Mahatma Gandhi, and one of whose primary political fronts is the BJP of Narendra Modi, the current Indian Prime Minister. The RSS was patterned after Mussolini's brown shirts, and as is the case with fascist groups, they unite their adherents by pointing to a malevolent other. In the case of Hindutva fascism, the malevolent other is Muslims, even after the partition of the British colony of India into India, modern-day India, and modern-day Pakistan, there is still a large Muslim minority in India, a significant portion of which is in the state of Uttar Pradesh. That's U-T-T-A-R, T as in Thomas, P-R-A-D-E-S-H. More about that later. Now, in connection with the RSS and the BJP and Narendra Modi, bear in mind that it was the RSS that killed Mahatma Gandhi. We spoke about that in For the Record 888 and 889. Bear in mind that Narendra Modi's BJP is a cat's paw, a political front for the RSS. Most of Modi's key political appointments were dictated to him by the RSS. The ascension of Modi's BJP was effected to a considerable extent but through the assistance of Pierre Omidyar of eBay. Omidyar's First Look Media and Intercept have become main staples, that's actually redundant, of the so-called progressive media establishment, perhaps more importantly, in addition to helping to elevate the Hindutva fascists of the RSS and the BJP in India. Pierre Omidyar also was fundamental in assisting the rise of the OUNB successor organizations in Ukraine. He has partnered with, among other institutions, the National Endowment for Democracy and the Agency for International Development, both of them cat's paws for U.S. intelligence. And it was Pierre Omidyar's First Look Media and Intercept that were the repository for Glenn Greenwald's files that he got from Edward Snowden containing classified information about the NSA. I believe that NSA is being actively blackmailed by what I call the Underground Reich and elements of the CIA, such as Edward Snowden and American WikiLeaker Jacob Applebaum. And I think that is one of the reasons why the frankly ludicrous notion of Russia hacking the various servers and interfering in the U.S. election has gone unchanneled. Suffice it to say, and as we speak, on July 18th, there is a rhetorical firestorm that is raging about Donald Trump's press conference with Vladimir Putin. And for once, Donald Trump, the ultimate broken clock, was right, which he is twice a day, but now he is under fire and walking that back. Suffice it to say that the most recent indictment by Robert Mueller charges that on July 27th of 2016, GRU, Russian military intelligence hackers, hacked into a computer operated, a server operated by Hillary Clinton. As Joe Loria of Consortium News has pointed out, Hillary Clinton's server was taken offline in 2015, and the contents of her emails turned over to congressional investigators, unless there is some server we had not been told about. Mueller's assertion is absolutely ludicrous. I've done many programs about the high-profile hacks. And in For the Record 1014, we took a look at information suggesting that Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State who networked with institutions like Pravi Sektor and Svoboda, and people like Andrei Parubyi, may very well have been someone who sent organizations like the Prop or Not group from Ukraine, people like Alexander Chalupa, organizations like CrowdStrike, linked to the Atlantic Council and the International Ukrainian Congress, or the World Ukrainian Congress, I'm not sure which off the top of my head, into the fray where they said, sure enough, it was Russia that committed the hacks. Again, the information that they did not is very compelling, and we are seeing a Warren Commission-esque dimension of lying on the part of our intelligence services that is really quite disgraceful. Suffice it to say that Pierre Omidyar helped to assist the Maidan coup that put in the OUNB successor organizations, and he had much to do with the elevation of Narendra Modi as well. We are going to take a look at the chief representative of Pierre Omidyar's Omidyar Network, his, quote, charitable, unquote, network in India, and his direct activism on behalf of the BJP and cow vigilantes. We're going to talk about that later. I also think that it is imperative to note that what is going on in India under Modi and the BJP and the RSS is very similar to the type of fascist myth-making and attendant xenophobia that is affecting world political affairs in Europe and the U.S. Certainly the Trump administration has been deeply involved with that. And that is not only the demonization of a malevolent other, in the case of the BJP, RSS, and Narendra Modi, the malevolent other is the Indian population, the Muslim population of India. But there is also the indication, the invocation of a mythical bygone golden age, a mythical lost period in which everything was wonderful. We spoke about that in For the Record 1013, where we recapped some of our conversations with Peter Lavenda. And we're going to take a look at that in this program as well, as Modi, as well as the Mr. Prabhupada, Swami Bhaktivedanta of the Hindutva fascist Hare Krishna cult. They cite a bygone Hindu idealistic period in which everything was wonderful, a Brahmanic paradise that was then corrupted by, you name it, foreigners, the British, Muslims, whoever. And that invocation of a mythical bygone golden age past is as central to the elevation of the Hindutva fascism of Narendra Modi as a similar invocation has been to the rise of fascism around the world, including the U.S. and Europe. We're going to take a look in the first part of our analysis at the enduring popularity of Adolf Hitler among a lot of people in India that is due in part to ignorance and due in part to the activities of a guy named Bal Thackeray, that's B-A-L, last name T-H-A-C as in Charlie, K-E-R-A-Y, and his Shiv Sena party. More about that later. What we're going to do, too, is to see how in time, with a little bit of media boosting, the historical reality of various things, in this case the Third Reich, can be modified. We have many times in the past cited the book Serpent's Walk, authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph B. Calderhall, C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L. The book is published in hardcover by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important of the American domestic Nazi groups. The book is, I think, far more than just the novel it purports to be. I think, in fact, it is a manifesto, a blueprint for what the Fascist International and the Underground Reich intend to do. It is about the SS going underground at the end of World War II. They certainly did that. And they build up their economic muscle. They certainly did that under the auspices of the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Network, about which we speak so often. And they buy into the opinion-forming media following the destruction of the U.S., or much of it, through a series of terrorist incidents using WMDs. Martial law is declared and they take over. But much of what happens in Serpent's Walk happens because of the taking over of the opinion-forming media by the SS, excerpting some elements, some passages from Serpent's Walk. They, the SS, realize that the world is heading towards a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. We, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we are slowly gaining. About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a supercorp that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, not with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little, so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats, and bad guys in black SS hats. Lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans. And we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes, and still more. Hell, if you can con Grammy into buying sugar turds instead of brand farts, then why can't you swing public opinion over to a cause as vital and important as ours? In any case, we're slowly replacing those negative images with others, the good bad guy routine. What do you think of Jesse James, John Dillinger, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan? The reality may have been rough, but there's a sort of glitter about most of those dudes. Mean honchos, but respectable. It's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. It works with anybody. Give it time. Aside from the media, we've been buying up private schools and helping some public ones through philanthropic foundations, and working on the churches and the born-agains. I would note that one of the main things we have spoken about in connection with Serpent's Walk is the Bertelsmann Corporation, which now controls roughly twice as much of the English language book publishing market as any competitor. It was the publishing house for the SS in World War II, and their house historian, Dirk Bovendam, as recently as 1998, published a book blaming World War II on Jewish control of the U.S. media and Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We mention this, and I cite that passage from A Serpent's Walk, because I think that it requires very little imagination to see A Serpent's Walk scenario in the publication, although it was withdrawn, of a children's book that lists Hitler as, quote, someone who will inspire you. From the New York Times of March 17th of 2018, by Kai, K-A-I, Schultz, S-C-H-U-L-T-Z, Indian children's book lists Hitler as leader, quote, who will inspire you, unquote. An Indian publisher came under fire this week for including Hitler in a children's book about world leaders who have, quote, devoted their lives for the betterment of their country and people, unquote. Skipping down. Published by the Pegasus imprint of India's B. Jain Publishing Group, the book called Leaders, unquote, but listed on the publisher's website, Great Leaders, unquote, spotlights 11 leaders who will inspire you, according to a product description on the publisher's website. On the book's cover, a stony-faced Hitler is featured alongside Barack Obama, Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, and India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. Placing Hitler alongside truly great political and humanitarian leaders is an abomination that is made worse as it targets young people with little or no knowledge of world history and ethics, Rabbi Cooper of the Simon Wiesenthal Center said in a statement. He also said, Adolf Hitler, this description would bring tears of joy to the Nazis and their racist neo-Nazi heirs, indeed. Continuing and skipping down. Anshu A-N-N-S-H-U Juneja, J-U-M-E-J-A, a publishing manager at the imprint, said by email that Hitler was featured because, like Barack Obama, Nelson Mandela, and Mahatma Gandhi, quote, his leadership skills and speeches influence masses, unquote. We are not talking about his way of conduct or his views or whether he was a good leader or a bad leader, but simply portraying how powerful he was as a leader, he said. Skipping down. In parts of Asia, atrocities committed in Nazi Germany are poorly understood, and Hitler is sometimes glorified as a strong, effective leader. In 2004, reports surfaced of high school textbooks in the state of Gujarat, which was then led by Mr. Modi, that spoke glowingly of Nazism and fascism. According to the Times of India, unquote, in a section called Ideology of Nazism, the textbook said Hitler had, quote, lent dignity and prestige to the German government. This again, a high school textbook in the state of Gujarat, which was then headed by Narendra Modi, and it speaks glowingly of Nazism and fascism. Modi is on the cover of the same book that places Hitler along, and Modi, not incidentally, alongside Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, and Barack Obama. According to the Times of India, in the section called Ideology of Nazism, the textbook said Hitler had, quote, lent dignity and prestige to the German government, unquote, made untiring efforts to make Germany self-reliant, unquote, and, quote, instilled the spirit of adventure in the common people, unquote. Only briefly does the book mention the extermination of millions of Jews and others by the end of World War II. Again, this book published in the state of Gujarat when it was led by Narendra Modi. This is distinct from the book Great Leaders that is the main focal point of this article. Continuing. Dilip D-I-L-I-P D'Souza, D apostrophe capital S-O-U-Z-A, an Indian journalist, wrote in a 2012 editorial that when 25 mostly upper-middle-class students taught by his wife at a private French school in Mumbai were asked to name the historical figure they most admired, 9 of them, again out of 25, picked Adolf Hitler. And what about the millions he murdered, asked my wife. Oh, yes, that was bad, said the kids. But you know what? Some of them were traitors, unquote. And in the article, which was a 2012 article from the Daily Beast, specifically from November 30th of 2012, this Dilip D'Souza article, Hitler's Strange Afterlife in India, reads in part as follows. Hated and mocked in much of the world, the Nazi leader has developed a strange following among school children and readers of Mein Kampf in India. Dilip D'Souza on how political leader Bal P.A.L. Thackeray, T-H-A-C-K-E-R-A-Y, influenced Indians to admire Hitler and despise Gandhi. My wife teaches French to 10th grade students at a private school here in Mumbai. During one recent class, she asked these mostly upper-middle-class kids to complete the sentence, J'admire, I admire, with the name of the historical figure they most admired. To say she was disturbed by the results would be to understate her reaction. Of 25 students in the class, 9 picked Adolf Hitler, making him easily the highest vote-getter in this particular exercise. A certain Mohandas Gandhi was a choice of precisely 1 student. Discussing the idea of courage with other students once, my wife was startled by the contempt they had for Gandhi. He was a coward, they said. And as far back as 2002, the Times of India reported a survey that found that 17% of students in elite Indian colleges favored Adolf Hitler as the kind of leader India ought to have. Again, as far back as 2002, the Times of India reported a survey that found that 17% of students in elite Indian colleges, quote, favored Adolf Hitler as the kind of leader India ought to have, unquote. In the place where Gandhi becomes a coward, perhaps Hitler does become a hero. Still, why Hitler? He was a fantastic orator, said the 10th grade kids. He loved his country. He was a great patriot. He gave back to Germany a sense of pride they had lost after the Treaty of Versailles, they said. And what about the millions he murdered, asked my wife. Oh, yes, that was bad, said the kids, but you know what? Some of them were traitors, unquote. Skipping down. This is no easily written-off experience. The evidence is that Hitler has plenty of admirers in India, plenty of whom are by no means kids. Consider Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography. Reviled it might be in much of the world, but Indians buy thousands of copies of it every month. As a recent paper in the journal EPW tells us, there are over a dozen Indian publishers who have editions of the book on the market. JAICO, J-A-I-C-O, for example, printed its 55th edition in 2010, claiming to have sold 100,000 copies in the previous 7 years. Contrast this to the 3,000 copies my own 2009 book, Roadrunner, has sold. In a country where 10,000 copies sold makes a book a bestseller, these are significant numbers. And the approval goes beyond just sales. Mein Kampf is available for sale on Flipkart.com, India's Amazon. As I write this, 51 customers have rated the book. 35 of those gave it a 5-star rating. What's more, there is a steady trickle of reports that say it has become a must-read for business school students, a management guide much like Spencer Johnson's Who Moved My Cheese or Edward de Bono's Lateral Thinking. If this undistinguished artist could take an entire country with him, I imagine the reasoning goes, surely his book has some lessons for future captains of industry. I suspect that some of these business students will find or have already found their way into the remarkable and deadly Borman network, an institution I believe will prove to be the dominant and decisive element in human affairs on this planet. Continuing, Much of Hitler's Indian afterlife is a legacy of Bal Thackeray, T-H-A-C-K-E-R-A-Y, chief of the Shiv Sena Party, who died on November 17th of 2012. Thackeray freely, openly, and often admitted his admiration for Hitler, his book, The Nazis and Their Methods. In 1993, for example, he gave an interview to Time magazine. "There is nothing wrong," he said then, "if Indian Muslims are treated as Jews were in Nazi Germany." This interview came only months after the December 1992 and January 1993 riots in Mumbai, which left about 1,000 Indians slaughtered, the majority of them Muslim. Thackeray was active right through these weeks, writing editorial after editorial in his party mouthpiece, Samna, S-A-A-M-N-A, or Confrontation is how it translates, about how to, quote, treat, unquote, Muslims. On December 9, 1992, for example, his editorial contained these lines: "Pakistan need not cross the borders and attack India. 250 Muslims in India will stage an armed insurrection. They form one of Pakistan's seven atomic bombs," unquote. A month later, on January 8th of 1993, there was this: "Muslims of Bendi Bazaar, Nol Bazaar, Dongri, and Pidoni, P-Y-D-H-O-N-I-E, the areas of Mumbai we call Mini Pakistan, must be shot on the spot," unquote. There was plenty more, too, much of it inspired by the failed artist who became Germany's Führer. After all, only weeks before the riots erupted, Thackeray said this about the Führer's famous autobiography, quote, "If you take Mein Kampf, and if you remove the word Jew and put in the word Muslim, that is what I believe in," unquote. With rhetoric like that, it is no wonder the streets of my city saw the slaughter of 1992 to 1993. It's no wonder kids come to admire a mass murderer, to rationalize away his massacres. It's no wonder they cling to almost comically superficial ideas of courage and patriotism, in which a megalomaniac's every ghastly crime is forgotten so long as we can pretend that he, quote, loved, unquote, his country. More about Bal Thackeray's Shiv Sena Party from the entry SHIV and second word SEMA in Wikipedia. The party had a powerful hold over the Bollywood film industry. It has been referred to as, quote, extremist, unquote, quote, chauvinist, unquote, as well as a fascist party, unquote. Shiv Sena has been blamed for the 1970 communal violence in Bhiwandi, B-H-I-W-A-N-B-I, the 1984 Bhiwandi riot, and violence in the 1992-1993 Bombay riots, skipping down. The party has been in coalition with the Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, for Lok Sabha, as well as Maharashtra Assembly since 1989. The two formed a government in Maharashtra between 1995 and 1999. The Sena was the opposition party in the state, along with the BJP, from 1999 to 2014. Again, the BJP is the political front for the Hindutva fascist RSS that killed Mahatma Gandhi and that was modeled after Mussolini's black shirts. That is Narendra Modi's political party.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Again, we talked about Pierre Omidyar and his support for Narendra Modi. We talked about that in various programs, including For the Record 795 and For the Record 889. Jayant, J-A-Y-A-N-T, Sinha, S-I-N-H-A, who was the lead advisor for the Omidyar Network in India, that is Omidyar's, quote, charitable, unquote, network, ultimately became Narendra Modi's finance minister after Omidyar helped to boost Narendra Modi into power, and now Jayant Sinha is a member of parliament. He was videoed placing garlands on 8 men who were convicted of killing a meat trader last year. And this is an entry into a major point, that of cow vigilantism. We have spoken about this in the past. The cow is sacred to the Hindu religion. Muslims and lower caste Hindus are the only ones who eat beef. And that eating of beef or marketing of beef is heavily stigmatized by the BJP, RSS, and others. And there has been a whole series of what are called cow vigilantes lynchings, basically the summary mob killings of people who either have eaten beef or marketed beef, or who have simply been suspected of killing cows or eating beef. And Jayant Sinha, again, the lead advisor for the Omidyar Network in India, Narendra Modi's former finance minister and a member of parliament, was garlanding, in other words, bestowing heroic honors on 8 of those killers. This from NDTV, that's Nancy Dog Thomas Victor, of July 6th of 2018, by Manish, M-A-N-I-S-H, Kumar, K-U-M-A-R. Minister Jayant Sinha garlands 8 men who killed meat trader in Jharkhand. That's J-H-A-R-K-A-N-D. Jayant Sinha, the union minister from Jharkhand, has landed himself in the middle of a row after the minister felicitated 8 men convicted of killing a meat trader last year. The controversy erupted after photographs emerged showing Jayant Sinha welcoming them at his residence. In sum, the union minister for civil aviation is also seen garlanding the 8 convicts at his residence on the outskirts of Hazaribagh, H-A-Z-A-R-I-B-A-G-H. This is despicable, Jharkhand's leader of opposition, Hemant Soren, H-E-M-A-N-T-S-O-R-E-N, tweeted in a stinging swipe at the union minister, tagging the minister's alma mater, the prestigious Harvard University of the U.S. Your alumnus at Jayant Sinha facilitating the accused in the cow-related lynching deaths in India. Is this what At Harvard stands for? Mr. Soren tweeted about Mr. Sinha, the BJP's Lok Sabha member from Hazaribagh. Ramarg Town, R-A-N-G-A-R-H, is also a part of this constituency. A total of 11 men, including a local BJP leader, were sentenced to a life term for beating Ahmadine to death on June 30th last year. The meat trader in Jharkhand was dragged out of his car and beaten to death by a mob that suspected he was carrying beef. As Alimuddin Ansari, A-L-I-M-U-D-D-I-N-A-N-S-A-R-I, 55, lay dying on a road in Ramgarh town last year, his car was also set on fire. The deadly attack by the self-styled cow vigilantes had come just a day after Prime Minister Narendra Modi had called, quote, killing people in the name of cow protection unacceptable, unquote. As we will see, this was essentially a public relations stance and stood in sharp contrast to Modi's previous reticence about cow vigilantism and lynching. Skipping down. The Raghubar Das government in Jharkhand decided to send a strong message, ordered the police to quickly probe the case and send it to a fast-track court. The court verdict came 9 months later in March of this year. They were convicted on the basis of a statement by Alimuddin's wife, Mariam Khatun, K-H-A-T-O-O-N. The police also came across a video that it said showed Nityanand Mato, M-A-H-T-O, 45, the district's BJP media in charge, dragging Alimuddin Ansari out of the car that a group of cow vigilantes had forced to stop near Ranchi. The mob took over from there and mercilessly thrashed him. Ajay Kumar of the Congress, too, expressed his shock at Mr. Sinha, who he said was considered, quote, among the most educated ministers in Prime Minister Modi's cabinet, openly supporting people convicted for murdering an innocent. Do they have no work to show except playing politics on dead bodies and dividing society, unquote, he said in an attack on the BJP. And as we will see, in addition to garlanding, in other words, placing flowers, congratulating and celebrating the man who had murdered in cold blood an alleged meat trader, Jayant Sinha then questioned the official investigation and moved to have that shifted to a different legal venue. This from the Hindustan Times of April 7th of 2018. Jayant Sinha wants CBI probe in Ramgarh lynching case in which 11 were convicted. This by Vishal, V-I-S-H-A-L, Kant, K-A-N-T. On March 21st, the court had awarded life imprisonment to 11 cow vigilantes, including a local BJP leader, for lynching 55-year-old Alimuddin alias Asghar Ali for carrying what they claimed was beef in his vehicle last year. Union Minister Jayant Sinha, again the former director of the Omidyar Network in India and Modi's former finance minister and now a member of parliament, Union Minister Jayant Sinha on Saturday demanded a Central Bureau of Investigation or CBI probe into the Ramgarh lynching, into the Ramgarh lynching case of a Muslim trader, raising doubts over the police investigation in which a local court convicted and awarded life sentences to 11 people last month. Skipping down. We respect the judicial process, but from whatever I have gathered after consultations and studying the various facets of the case, I firmly believe that complete justice has not been done. I'm not a police officer, and I have not done a detailed inquiry, but as per my understanding, complete justice has not been done. I consulted senior lawyers and also took advice from the party, the BJP, on the matter. I had decided to write to the Jharkhand Chief Minister, Raghubar Das, requesting him to recommend a CBI probe, the minister said. The Court of Additional District Judge Om Prakash held guilty all of the accused under Section 302, murder and other offenses of the IPC, making it the first case in the country in connection with cow vigilantism and related violence in which the accused were convicted. The BJP-ruled Jharkhand witnessed a series of lynching of Muslim cattle traders in the months of May and June of 2017. And again, this reminds me a little bit of Donald Trump and his often unique takes on racial incidents. Now, the next article is one from the New Republic of July 26th of last year, 2017. It is very important, and it not only chronicles the large number of lynchings by cow vigilantes, but it places the elevation of the cow and Hindu mythology in the context of the common fascist meme of a long ago idealized past that is basically mythical, but that can be ultimately restored and recapitulated if, quote, those people, unquote, in this case Muslims, can be somehow neutralized. Very important, we talked about that in 2013 in our discussions with Peter Lavenda. Again, New Republic, July 26th of 2017, How Cow Vigilantes Launched India's Lynching Epidemic. This by Amar Diwakar, D-I-W-A-K-A-R. India has been beset by a wave of gruesome lynchings, and at the epicenter of the country's violent upheaval is the indolent cow. Emboldened by an ascendant Hindu nationalist movement coupled with a controversial government ban on cattle slaughter, so-called cow vigilante groups have been carrying out a ruthless form of mob justice, summarily executing those suspected of killing, trading, or consuming beef. India's embattled minorities, particularly Muslims, have borne the brunt of the violence, confirming the worst suspicions about what Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his brand of Hindu chauvinism would unleash on the country. The atrocities have steadily been mounting. In September of 2015, Mohammed Akhlaq, a.k.a. LAQ, was hanged over rumors that he killed a cow and refrigerated its meat. A month later, 16-year-old Zahid Rasul Bhatt was slain by vigilante groups. In March of this year, suspected cattle traders Mohammed Majloom and Azad Khan were lynched. In April, 55-year-old dairy farmer Pelu Khan was accused of smuggling cows and was brutally beaten to death by a mob. In May, traders were assaulted for alleged beef storage, and Abu Hanifa and Riazuddin Ali were killed for purportedly stealing cattle. In June, Ainul Ansari was attacked on suspicion of transporting beef, while 15-year-old Junaid Khan was stabbed to death by a mob after being branded a beef eater. Since September of last year, there have been more than a dozen lynchings across the country. Modi, who was defeated by Donald Trump at the White House in June, has been ominously quiet on the issue. However, he belatedly issued a statement saying this is unacceptable, as we looked at earlier. Continuing. Two cases in particular of Pelu Khan and Junaid Khan offer the starkest evidence to date that an indelible rot, is growing in the Indian Republic. This last sentence again. Two cases in particular of Pelu Khan and Junaid Khan offer the starkest evidence to date that an indelible rot is growing in the Indian Republic. Pelu Khan's death at the hands of cow vigilantes in Rajasthan occurred with the complicity of the crowd who collectively bayed for his execution. It was also captured on camera and subsequently watched by millions on social media. Just as chilling was the muted response that followed, as Atish Tasir argued in the column for the New York Times. Like all forms of theater, a lynching depends on what is left unsaid. It creates a mood, an atmosphere. The silence that settles in after the euphoric act of violence, which all have witnessed, tells a minority group that it has been forsaken. It is this element of a suggestive and creeping threat in which the state apparatus and a silent majority are complicit that has the power to demoralize a community as much as the physical acts of violence themselves. In the case of Junaid Khan, police were unable to produce a witness for the grim spectacle of his stabbing death, despite the fact that some 200 people had been assembled on the railway platform in Haryana where the killing took place. This kind of, quote, unseeing, unquote, has become common. As Arti Sethi writes, lynchings are a, quote, social non-event in contemporary India, unquote. This is an extreme form of alienation in which Hindus have chosen to disregard the dead body of a Muslim child. In doing so, they symbolically withdrew Junaid's membership from the entire socio-political order. The country's ruling right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, under the stewardship of Modi and his openly Hindutva Hindu First platform, have done little to stem the rise in communal tensions. They have not denounced this barbarism with conviction, only paying reluctant lip service in the face of incessant public pressure. In fact, much of the hysteria over the cow, a sacred animal in Hinduism, was shrewdly engineered. During Modi's election campaign in 2014, by the way, aided by Pierre Omidyar, he railed against a, quote, pink revolution, unquote. a euphemism for India's $5 billion a year export meat industry. The color pink is a reference to the color of beef, which was flourishing under Congress party rule. The industry is concentrated in Uttar Pradesh, providing direct or indirect employment to around 2.5 million people. The sector is dominated by Muslims, but also provides work to low-caste Hindus, which means the surge in cow protectionism has had a disproportionate impact on those communities. And by the way, one of the things that we looked at in For the Record 990, Modi Operandi, was Modi's appointment of the Hindu extremist cleric Jyoti Aditya Nath, who to be the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh. Jyoti Aditya Nath worshipped at a temple, one of whose leaders was actually detained for advocating the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi. And it was, as we looked at, and for the record, 888 and 889, it was... 988 and 989, excuse me, again, for the record, 988 and 989, it was the RSS that murdered Gandhi, and the BJP of Narendra Modi is a political front for the RSS, again, modeled after Mussolini's black shirts.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Continuing. Do you want to support people who want to bring about a pink revolution? Modi bellowed on the campaign trail. It should come as no surprise that, in the 3 years since the BJP took the reins of power, India has witnessed a growing climate of intolerance against minorities. Whipping up communal strife is a necessary part of the Hindu nationalist playbook. But the roots of the current crisis, in which the life of a cow is considered more sacred than that of a teenage boy, go much deeper than Modi, reaching into the fundamental battle for modern India's soul between illiberal Hindutva forces and a pluralistic tradition that has rarely looked so vulnerable. This is why Modi's adherents have constructed a grand monolithic narrative to justify their actions, one that proclaims cultural continuity of tradition and that pivots upon a retrograde Brahmanical core. The complex history of the priestly caste is papered over with strident assertions of Brahmanical purity, of which vegetarianism and the sanctity of the cow are indispensable components. Under this worldview, the golden age of Hindu rule in the Vedic period, subsequently sullied by foreign pollutants, the British, yes, but the rapacious Muslims in particular, is to be channeled into 21st century renewal, piloted by an arbitrary set of, quote, Hindu values, unquote. And foremost among these is the inviolability of the cow. However, this schema suffers from a significant flaw. A pristine and contiguous Hindu civilization in which the cow's sanctity was upheld is disputed by the historical record. It is little more than embellished myth-making. Much like other appeals to a bygone era of civilizational supremacy and homogeneity, it is thoroughly a product of modernity. Skipping down. The BJP, as well as its ideological parent organization, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS, peddle a version of nationalism that prioritizes exclusivity in which Indians are rigidly defined by ethnicity and religion. The trope of the cow is thus a convenient instrument measuring the allegiance to the nation along gastronomical and thereby spiritual lines. Non-Hindus are deemed a surplus population, and violence against them is sanctioned in an attempt to cleanse the true body politic. We have seen versions of this story play out across the world in response to the failures of technocratic elites and the supposed champions of pluralistic democracy. In India's case, the Congress Party became mired in corruption scandals, paving the way for Modi and the BJP to present themselves as pragmatic reformers. And indeed, that is how Modi is generally conveyed in the international press, with a focus on his attempts to overhaul India's sclerotic tax system and to root out endemic corruption. Sound familiar? Quote, draining the swamp, unquote. Continuing. But the crucial ingredient is the way Modi has tapped into the nostalgic impulse. Svetlana Boym, B-O-Y-M, a Russian-American philologist, has described this as the historical emotion, unquote, of modernity, and argued that attempts to create a, quote, phantom homeland, unquote, through ahistorical restoration would only breed monstrous consequences. As she writes in her book, The Future of Nostalgia, it is a, quote, restorative nostalgia, unquote, that is, quote, at the core of recent national and religious revivals. It has two main plots, the return to origins and the conspiracy, unquote. And so, we inhabit a landscape where Make America Great caps, Little England, the Hindu Rashtra, and the Islamic Caliphate have arrested the imagination of millions. These are all overtures to an Edenic past, that's Edenic as in Eden past, promising an order that preserves tradition by purifying society of contagion. Skipping down. Modi's two central agendas, economic development and Hindu cultural revival, compete with one another for headlines. Yet his commitment to pandering to the far right has never truly been in question. The creation of communal discord crystallizes the BJP's ambition to alter history and hegemonize Indian values, unquote, as exclusively Hindu values. The party has eagerly deployed Hindu symbols and myths to convert nostalgia into electoral support. So far, this approach has been extremely successful. Close to half of Indians now dwell in BJP-controlled states, devoid of an effective opposition. I'm going to briefly touch on an article here. This from the New York Times of February 5th of 2018. It is by Suhasini, S-U-H-A-S-I-N-I, Raj, R-A-J, and Kai Schultz, again, K-A-I, capital S-C-H-U-L-T-Z. After religious clash in India, rumors create a false martyr, unquote. And this concerns a town in the state of Uttar Pradesh, again, a state in which Indians and Muslims have generally lived in relative harmony. And also the largest state in India. It is a state now presided over by Hindu fanatic Yogi Adityanath, having been appointed as chief minister of Uttar Pradesh by Narendra Modi. And the article reads in part, during celebrations on India's Republic Day of January 26th, a clash broke out between Hindus and Muslims in the city of Kasjan, that's K-A-S-G-A-N-J, I'm probably mispronouncing that. Schools, shops, and a mosque were damaged. One person was killed. Another merely had his eye gouged out. Mr. Upadhyay, 24, stayed away from the violence, bunkering down inside his home in a nearby village. But the following evening, a friend called to share a peculiar bit of news. you have been elevated to being a martyr. The point being, I'm not going to read the whole article, it is reproduced almost in its entirety in the written description for the record 1015, which will be available shortly after the program is recorded. That basically social media took off, and the rumor that this guy had been killed became an established fact, and he was elevated to being a Hindu martyr. Skipping down. Khazjan was not always like this. For much of its history, Muslims and Hindus coexisted peacefully in this dusty city about 100 miles east of New Delhi. And in the years since Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party rose to power in 2014, violent outbreaks between Hindus and Muslims had become more common in some pockets of India. And again, the article goes on to talk about that. I'm going to conclude the program with an article that is, to me, somewhat amusing and also disgusting. Last year, 2017, was the 50th anniversary of the so-called Summer of Love. And there was much reverse peristalsis-inducing celebration of the Haight-Ashbury and lots of people taking LSD. By the way, LSD was developed by the Nazi SS during World War II as a disabling agent. And there is an interesting footnote to the, quote, Summer of Love and the whole hippie thing. In the Mantra Rock entry under the Hare Krishna movement, it talks about Sunday, January 29th of 1967. This day marked the major spiritual event of the San Francisco hippie era, and Srila Prabhupada, he is the head of the founder of the Hare Krishna sect. We spoke at length about him in For the Record 991. Who was ready to go anywhere to spread Krishna consciousness was there. The Grateful Dead, Moby Grape, Janis Joplin, and Big Brother and the Holding Company, the Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, all the New Wave San Francisco bands had agreed to appear with Prabhupada at the Avalon Ballroom's Mantra Rock Dance, proceeds from which would go to the local Hare Krishna Temple. By the way, Timothy Leary, closely associated with the CIA, was there as well. The event was wildly successful, and again, with the creme de la creme of San Francisco psychedelic bands presiding over the event, it helped to raise a lot of money for the Hare Krishna sect. In For the Record 991, we went into the fascist cult, the Hare Krishna. It is indeed a Hindutva fascist cult which reveres Hitler, is openly racist, and which, like the mythical past of Narendra Modi and the RSS, looks to a bygone time of Brahmanic Hindu Vedic purity as one to then be recapitulated by the Hare Krishna. I have included many verbatim quotes from the ideology of Prabhupada and discussed at length in For the Record 991. It should be noted that in addition to his open contempt for democracy and his support for dictatorship, the aforementioned Prabhupada has basically talked about a bygone time in which everything was pure. He talks about this as the Aryan, basically the time of the preeminence of the Aryans. And again, I went into this at length in For the Record 991, and many of the quotes are reproduced at length in the description for the Record 1015. Suffice it to say that at a fundamental level, the Hare Krishna sect looks back to a mythical, idealized Vedic past, one of Brahmanic purity, and it sees itself as a vehicle whereby we can return in the future to this mythical, idealized past of Brahmanic and Vedic purity. This is quite explicit in the philosophy of Prabhupada. And again, the man is openly anti-black, openly quote, Aryan, unquote, sees white people as part of the Aryan race, like many Indians. He is very opposed to Native Americans, black people, has some very choice things to say about women as well. Again, we went into this at great length in For the Record 991, and his statements and ideology are reproduced at length in the description for the Record 1015. Suffice it to say that at the core of the Hare Krishna sect is the same desire to return in the future to a mythical, idealized, and in fact non-existent past, a form of atavistic fascism. This concludes For the Record program number 1015, Update on Hindutva Fascism. This is being recorded on July 18th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.